Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish of Stowe and Acton, a Unitarian Universalist welcoming congregation. We're so glad that you're here with us today, particularly if it's your first time or you're fairly new to the congregation. Today is a little more of a low-key Sunday. I can see a little bit of wear and tear on all of you after a long day at the fair, and our choir sang at the fair yesterday, so they're off. So we're going to be a little bit more low-key, but we'll wake you up, I promise. I think we want to start, as we always do at the service, with an opportunity to greet our neighbor. And I'd invite you particularly to reach out to anyone who might be new or fairly recent to the congregation. Please give your best and ask them to join us for coffee hour. We'll enter into our time of worship by lighting our chalice flame, the chalice being the symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, and by symbolically bringing together a spark of the divine that burns in each of us to light a common flame. We represent how we come together in common purpose to light a beacon that can reach out to the world with love and justice and peace. And to light our chalice this morning, we've invited members of our Religious Education Committee. So, Michelle, do you have some others with you? Great. Good. And as they light the chalice, I'd like to share with you some words from the ancient Indian Sanskrit tradition, a poet by the name of Kalidasa from the 5th century B.C., who wrote, "Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence, the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day." Please be seated and attentive to a message from our Director of Religious Education, Michelle Cote.
Good morning. So Tom today in his sermon is speaking of wasted time. And I thought, this is a message for all ages, so for kids through adults. What could I focus on that would have value and meaning? And I think one of the things certainly is that, you know, as kids or even as adults, sometimes we say, "Oh, you're wasting time. You're just sitting there reading a book or watching TV, and that's a waste of time." To me, that's not necessarily a negative waste of time, because we all need time to just chill and to not be busy all the time. But one type of wasted time that I do feel is just a toxic, it's a bad way to spend time, is to waste your time in anger against someone else. So I found this story that I thought spoke very much to that, called The Forgiveness Garden, written by Lauren Thompson, and I'm going to share that story with you today. There was a valley, and through the valley ran a stream. The village of Vayam stood on one side, and the village of Gamte stood on the other. There was no peace in that valley, for the two villages had hated each other for a long, long time. One day, a new argument sparked. Both villages claimed a certain part of their stream as their own. Angry words flew across the stream. Soon, stones started being thrown across the stream. A Gamte boy named Karun picked up a large stone and hurled it across the water. A Vayam girl named Sama stood where the stone fell. The stone hit Sama hard on the head, and she fell to the ground. The villagers of Vayam ran to help. The villagers of Gamte cheered and ran away. The Vayams called out for revenge. They were angry. And for those of us that are here that might not know what revenge means, can someone tell us, what does revenge mean? Yes, Luke. Okay, to give them a taste of their own medicine, to be mean back to them. And that's certainly not something that is to me, the best way to handle it, but it's how they decided to do it in this story. As days passed, Sama's pain began to lessen, but her hatred of the Gamtes grew. And in the village of Gamte, too, the people were angry, and they were afraid. And they thought, would the Vayams fight us always? They gathered around Karun, praising his courage and scheming how to defend against the Vayams. However, Karun secretly wondered if really he had been brave, but his hatred for the Vayams only grew. One day, Sama walked along the stream, yearning for something to ease her angry, aching heart. She reached a calm pool and bent to drink. What she saw, reflected, stopped her. She saw first her ugly scar from the stone, but most of all, she saw her own dark, brooding scowl, and a scowl is a very angry face. "Who have I become?" she cried. Sama wept for a long time over the anger that she had wasted. Then Sama looked across the stream. There, a few children from Gamte walked together. How scared and angry and sad they looked. Sama's heart softened. "They are just like us," she thought. Suddenly, a few of Sama's own people ran up. "Here you are," they shouted. "The time for revenge has come." And they pulled her away to join in the fight. Villages from Vayam and Gamte crowded the stream, and the Vayams held a captive, and a captive is someone that you're holding against your will. And it was the boy Karun, and they all held stones in their hands. A large stone was put into Kasama's hands. It was the stone that Karun had thrown at her. "Throw the stone at him," her people hissed, "and throw it hard." Sama looked at all the villagers, those from Vayam and those from Gamte. Their faces were like hers had been, hardened with anger and fear and hate. Suddenly, Sama knew what she had to do. "No," she said in a loud, clear voice, "I won't hurt him. Let the boy go." Her people grumbled. Sama went on. "It is time to stop the fighting," she said. "We must stop hurting and hating," and she flung the large stone to the ground. "Let us build a garden instead," she said. Now all of the people grumbled. Someone shouted, "What kind of garden?" Sama knew what to say. "A forgiveness garden." Some people gasped, some scoffed, some just laughed. But some from Vaya murmured, "If Sama wants it," they let Karun go. Then they piled their stones near Sama's. Some from Gamte saw this and murmured, "It's worth a try." They added stones of their own. Only Karun hung back, still feeling scared and angry. Stone by stone, the people of the valley built a garden wall together. But they had questions. "If we forgive, must we also forget all that has happened?" asked the villagers of Vayam. Sama answered, "We will sit together in the garden and decide." "Must we apologize?" asked the villagers of Gamte. "Will the Vayams apologize to us?" Sama answered, "The garden will help us find what is right." Still, Karun stayed apart, watching and thinking. Villagers set flowers into the soil and planted a tree. When the garden was complete, its loveliness made everyone smile. "This garden is for all of us," Sama said. "It can help us put aside hate and learn what forgiveness feels like. Who will join me?" At first, no one moved. No one dared. The two villages had hated each other for a long, long time. It was hard to try something new. Then Karun, brave Karun, stepped forward. "I will join you," he said to Sama. Sama of Vayam and Karun of Gamte stepped into the garden together. There they sat under the tree and they began to talk. And this is for you to think about during the week or later today. What do you think they said to each other? And I want to challenge you as you go through your life this week and you have those people that irritate you, or your parents say something that you just can't stand, or your kids do something that you just can't stand, or someone cuts you off on the road and you just get filled with that sense of anger, to see if you can find that forgiveness garden in yourself and to go to the place of forgiveness rather than the place of anger and see how that makes you feel about your time and the value you put on your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. It is our custom here that when our children or youth go to their religious education classes, they are led by a lantern, which is illuminated from the common flame that we lit at the beginning of the service. It's an honor to carry the lantern, and when we do, everyone going follows the lantern bearer all around the church and then up the store. And my understanding is that Jack Sullivan is going to carry the lantern for us today. So, Jack, if you would come forward and light it, and then remember, everyone follows Jack out that's going to religious education. When we come together each week, we bring with us the joys, the sorrows, and the concerns of our week. There are sadnesses that we need to share, and by sharing them, it lessens our pain a bit. There are joys that just call out to be broadcast to others, and thereby sharing the joy, spreading that joy around. And there are concerns which are worthy for all of us to hear. If you've come today with a significant joy, sorrow, or concern in your heart, we invite you to share it by standing, and one of our helpers will bring you a microphone and another will light a candle for you, that candle symbolizing that that person, that thought, or that prayer is here with us today. Helping us with joys and concerns today will be two of our lay ministers we have with us here today, Marvin Drake and Marcia Rising, if that's okay. Can you both assist? And also is Jolene... There she is. Our membership developed. She moved on me. I usually know where to look for her. Our membership and welcoming coordinator, Jolene Sullivan. Are you okay? All right. Please raise your hand if you'd like to share this morning.
Good morning. My name's Ann Wickham, and I'd like to light a candle of joy and gratitude. Many of you know our son, Nathan, who went off to Dean College a month ago, a freshman year. When we dropped him off, he said that we could not be in touch with him for a month. So all of you kindly asked how he was doing, and I said, I don't know. But we saw him last night, and we were greeted with that warm Nathan hug, and I'm just really happy to share that he's thriving.
Hi, I'm Barbara Robb, and I would like to light 100 candles of joy for everybody who stepped up to make our fair such a wonderful success. Last week, I stood up really nervous if we were going to get enough people to volunteer and get enough donations, and we did. It was awesome. But since we can't light 100 candles, let's see how many we can do for the leaders of each of the fair tables, because that really made my job easy. Everybody has combined decades of experience in running these various tables, and they were here Friday. Friday night, Friday afternoon, all day yesterday, and really did a lot. So I'm going to make sure I don't miss anybody. The baked goods table, Diane Miller and Liz Mosley. Jewelry, Rebecca Stadalnik, who is really superwoman this time of year with Between the Pies and the awesome job she does with jewelry. Ruth Ann Murray for lunch. She did a great job shopping and making sure that everything was attractively arranged. Carolyn Zettler did the pies in the coffee stand. Jenny Edgerton and Jen Atkins did a great job with a new thing that we've brought back, the toys and the games table. Tom and the staff did a great job with the raffle. Susan Avery reinvigorated our crafts table again. Wanda Null and Troy Liston did a great job with the books. Janet Beatrice organized all of the music, and we had a wonderful selection of musicians performing all day. And Keith and Dawn Olcott had the fair trade table. And a final candle for anybody that I forgot, because there were so many people, but thank you all.
And I think we should light one candle for Barbara, who organized the whole thing.
I'm Nancy Cataldo, and I'd like to light a candle for the recovery of my father-in-law, Judy's father, and my role model, who at 93 years old opted to have his second knee replacement this past week. He's recovering. He's getting out of the hospital today. And he did this in order to do a pilgrimage to the Holy Land in January. So I wish him all the best.
I'm Kathy Haberly.
Amen. I'd like to invite you into a time of silent meditation and prayer with this beautiful poem by David White. Sometimes you need the ocean light and the colors you've never seen before painted through an evening sky. Sometimes you need your God to be a simple invitation, not a telling word of wisdom. Sometimes you need only the first shyness that comes from being shown things far beyond your understanding, so that you can fly and become free by being still and by being still here. And then there are times you need to be brought to ground by touch and touch alone, to know those arms around you and to make your home in the world just by being wanted. To see those eyes looking back at you as eyes should see you at last. Seeing you as you always wanted to be seen. Seeing you as you yourself had always wanted to see the world. For the reading this morning, I'd like to share just a very simple little poem by Audrey Heller. Instead of trying to win an argument, try to find common ground. Make sure what you're saying is solid and sound. It's easy to nitpick, but who needs it anyway? Don't you think there are much more important things to do, so it's smart to walk away? Some things are really not worth arguing about. For you, probably won't get anywhere. Sometimes it's best to leave it up in the air. What's the use in continuing as long as there is no right or wrong? Later on, when you look back, you'll be glad that you moved on. Well, as that hymn just reminds us, there are lots of different theologies within Unitarian Universalism. You may believe in one of them, and I in another, and we could argue all day long about who is right. And of course, the differences within our tradition really pale when you compare our beliefs to those of other faith traditions. And we could spend a lot of time debating who is right and who is wrong. And that brings me to a story. Those of you who know and been here before know that I love a good story, and I think this is one. In a small, pretty typical town, there lived an elderly woman who every morning would go out on her porch and raise her arms in the air and shout, "Praise God!" An atheist moved in next door to the woman, and seeing her morning ritual, is annoyed by it. So every morning, when the woman goes out on her porch and shouts her praises to God, he comes out on his porch and yells back, "There is no God." The daily exchange goes on for years. One winter, the woman experiences some hard times. And one day, she went out on the porch and she shouted, "Praise God, I spent the food money on heat, and now I have no food in the house, and I'm going hungry. Please provide for me, God." The next morning, she steps out on her porch, and lo and behold, there are two full bags of groceries by the door. "Praise God," she proclaimed. "God has met my needs. He provided me with the groceries." Just then, the atheist neighbor jumps out and shouts back, "There is no God. I bought the groceries for you." Without hesitation, the woman throws her arms in the air again and shouts, "Praise God who provided me with the groceries in my time of need and even made the devil pay for them." Have you been there? As a religious liberal, have you at some time perhaps been accosted by religious conservatives who think they are saving your soul by preaching to you that what you believe in is wrong, showing you the errors of your ways? And how effective was that? Did that encounter change your thinking a lot, your core beliefs? And it can be the other way around. Perhaps you are so convinced that your liberal belief, maybe a belief that there is no God, is so unquestionably true that it propels you to preach your truth to those who believe differently. And let me ask you, how often have you converted one of the devout fundamentalist believers to accept your point of view? Not many times, I suspect. I think the message of the story is one that's probably confirmed time and again in our daily lives. No matter what you do or say to persuade those who are firmly predisposed to not agree with your idea of the truth, chances are pretty good that it's going to be a waste of time. And more than that, the encounter will probably make the differences that separate you even more entrenched. Now, I'm not talking about a conversation with someone who might be looking for a new path or open to new ideas. I'm talking about trying to convert the dyed-in-the-wool believer in some theology. In words of one of my good colleagues, Reverend Mark Stringer, he writes, "As I see it, conversations about theological concepts over which none of us can be certain can be so burdened with definitive assertions of right and wrong that they quickly devolve into tedious, self-righteous, and counterproductive attempts at conversion. When it comes to religion, it seems one person's reason is often another person's lunacy." So, I guess it is pretty much a waste of time. Please understand, I'm not suggesting that we should not be in relationship with those whose religious ideas are dramatically different from our own. To the contrary, we have to be. But locking horns over religious beliefs doesn't accomplish much. Yelling your truth at someone else who's yelling their truth back does little to change minds and perhaps worse, causes us to fail to make a meaningful connection with someone who believes very differently than we do. So does it make sense to try and change people's ideas on their most fundamental beliefs? Well, the story that I shared with you would suggest probably not, but let's explore it a little bit more. I think back to when I was a child. I remember a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses who would come by the house regularly, knock on the door, ready to hand us their magazines. I remember it was called The Watchtower and Awake. Remember that? My mother developed this ritual where she would go to the door, literally toss them a quarter, refuse the magazine, and close the door while they were still talking. Now, my mother's a polite person, but I think it was just her, and that's why I think the quarter was there. But I think it was just her way of saying, well, here's a little something, but I'm not interested in changing my beliefs. I didn't encounter Jehovah's Witnesses for quite a while after that. Years later, they started coming to my house in Worcester. And usually when they showed up, I would just say something like, I'm busy, I can't talk now, or something to that effect. But a couple of years ago, when they knocked on the door, I think I was feeling a little bit devilish. I said that I would listen to them talk about their religion for 5 minutes if they would listen to me talk about mine for the same length of time. I still didn't let them in the house. But we talked on the front steps for about 10 minutes. And a few interesting things came out of the conversation. I learned Jehovah's Witnesses, like our Unitarian forebears, rejected the idea of the Trinity and even the divinity of Jesus. For Jehovah's Witnesses, good works are essential to salvation. Now, we may not define salvation in the same way, but we, you religious liberals, can pretty much make that same statement. Maybe more important than what I took from them was what I was able to expose them to. I spoke of our inclusive religion, welcoming people of different beliefs and honoring the inherent worth of dignity of every person, including the GBLT folks, which I know that weren't their favorites. I told them about a church where love and justice and human compassion were central. One where there was no threat of harsh judgment and everyone's voice exercised through the democratic process was important. A church that professed the interdependent web of all existence. Well, I didn't become a Jehovah's Witness, and they certainly didn't become Unitarian Universalists. But something happened in this encounter. We each listened to the other, and perhaps were a little, just a little, less judgmental of the other. You know, generally, I believe we really should not use our time trying to change the fundamental beliefs of others. But there's certainly an argument to be advanced to the contrary. There certainly are consequences for others from the beliefs we hold, especially when we bring them into the societal or to the political realm. Some would say we religious liberals are too accommodating of the religious beliefs of others, that it's our moral duty to speak out against theologies that we believe are wrong for no other reason than because they affect real-world situations. Theological beliefs can be dangerous, and therefore some of us may feel the need to do our best to change other people's beliefs. For example, people who feel human life begins at the moment of conception try to put that into practice, not only preventing women to have reproductive control, but also to prevent the critical embryonic research needed to cure some of the most challenging diseases of our time. People whose deep theological belief is that homosexuality is a sin, will undoubtedly work to restrict the rights of gays and lesbians where they can. So perhaps we should be directly engaging and challenging people's beliefs. you know, of course it would be better if we could change the whole thing, change someone's complete orientation to match ours. You know? And you can make that statement if you are a fundamentalist Christian, or you are an atheist, or you are anywhere in between on the spectrum. You've probably tried to do some version of this at some point in your life, change another person's fundamental belief. My question is, how'd that work for you? Not very well, I bet. Perhaps it was a waste of time. I guess I come down on the side that I would really love for others to believe as I do, but I don't want to waste my life in a logjam. I would rather find those places where we can agree, where we can work together on something important. This has always been my approach in our interfaith dialogues right here in this area, working together with clergy who hold profoundly different views from mine. And it's not been easy for me, for some of them hold religious views that strike at the very core of who I am. You know, probably most of you don't know this, but 15 years ago, when I first joined the local clergy association, some of the fundamentalist clergy stopped coming to it because they had let a gay person in. I had to address the issue of how, as a gay man, I could work together with someone who believes that just being who I am is an abominable sin, who doesn't think I should be allowed to be a minister, who doesn't think I should even be allowed to be at that table. So how to engage them? Well, I can tell you, it was not to challenge their theology on the issue every time we met, even though that was often what I would like to have done. But one way to make this kind of engagement across vastly different worlds work is to stick with what you can agree on and get something done. This message does not only apply to theological differences, it applies in our political world as well. And I think one of the most disappointing things to me about our government at the moment is that we seem unable to get things done, even in areas where we should be able to find agreement. I think we as citizens are more polarized than ever and prefer to demonize each other rather than even consider what we might accomplish together. Well, away from politics, let's get back closer to home and back to religion. Right here, Stowe, for many years, I had a really excellent relationship with the late Father Dick Butler, who was the pastor of St. Isidore's Church for many years. Some of you may remember that he even preached here on the subject of peace, and I spoke at his church. And in doing that, we both refrained from speaking about theological issues where we disagreed, even though both of us would probably have liked to do that. I remember the day he showed up at our peace vigil, and then ailing in health on a cold day, stood with a bunch of mostly UUs and held a sign demanding an end to the war in Iraq. And there were the behind-the-scenes things that happened. He had sort of a droll tone, and he would call me and say, "There's a family in town in trouble. We can pay the rent from our St. Vincent de Paul fund. Can you pay the utilities from your minister's discretionary fund?" We often worked this way. And sometimes we drove to meetings together, and we would talk on the edge of theology, I guess I would say. He would acknowledge something he felt was good about Unitarian Universalism or about our church, and I would talk about some Catholic teaching or practice that I found meaningful. We never directly confronted each other's core beliefs. No minds really changed. But we came to understand and respect each other, stayed in relationship, and we've got some things done. During the gay marriage debate, I worked hard as part of a clergy team to get Massachusetts legislators to pass equal marriage. And I spoke to many religiously conservative legislatures whose position on homosexuality was not about to change. I knew that the direct confrontation with their core beliefs was not going to accomplish much. So I and many others thought it better to come from the side. I talked about loving families with children who could not get health insurance. I talked about people who could not be with their life partners at the end of their life or participate in their medical decisions. My appeal was to love and compassion and universal fairness, especially for children. On these we could agree. We didn't talk about religious beliefs or sin or God's plan for the world, but I felt we did God's work. Votes were changed and the legislation passed. I have to confess, when I was younger, my efforts were more likely to go directly for the big issue, to proclaim my truth and try and convert others to it. And I think much of the time, that was in fact a waste of time. I think there were missed opportunities. So I guess I've softened. Instead of focusing on where we disagree, let's find the areas where we can work together. Instead of shouting out the beliefs that differ from ours, let's try at least to understand them a bit. Maybe even find a few ideas we can respect in traditions that are very different from our own. Let's connect wherever we can connect. There are big issues in our world right now where people can work together, but in doing so, they're motivated by very different religious beliefs. I think a prime example where it is possible to address a problem from very many different religious perspectives and work together is that of climate change and global warming. But we should also be able to come together around issues like immigration, as the teachings of love and welcoming your neighbor exist in every religion that I know about. And why couldn't we work together on things like the corruption of money in politics? These all have religious warrants in both the most liberal and the most conservative faiths I know of. You could work on either one drawing from those traditions. In more difficult issues, where our fundamental beliefs are really directly in conflict, maybe we can come from the side and work at the edges to accomplish something. You know, like every other religion, you have the right to and should proclaim your faith as you understand it. And there are fundamental differences that do matter, and we should not compromise them. But as people of very different faiths know, at a deep level, there is much more that unites us than divides us. That's where we need to go. That's where the real work of lived religion can happen. We need to stop demonizing each other, stop drawing the line in the sand that we can't cross, stop making it all or nothing, and work together with those with whom we disagree on even some of the most fundamental and emotional matters of faith. Every time we do this, a little trust is built, a little more respect established, and an opening to try to do it again emerges. I'm right out there, and you know this, when it comes to proclaiming even the most controversial parts of our faith. But I'm also ready to unite with those with whom I vehemently disagree if we can accomplish something important. Our engagement with those who think very differently should not be a debate about who is right on the big questions, but instead a discussion of how we can work together to help people and even save the world. We should not build walls with theology, but rather we should build bridges with our hearts. It's possible to do this in small ways every day. And as we do, what divides us will lessen, and what unites us increase. We may not have won the theological issue, but I honestly believe that in doing so, we will have blessed the world in some way. Thank you.